Let's, Robert, can you go first?
Sure.
All right, and then can we have a first responder, someone to encourage Robert on his work and also ask a question for deeper thought?
I can do this.
All right, Josh.
Oh, Josh.
And our goal is to basically, you know, you can only present so much in 5 minutes, and so we go that extra step and help all of us figure out how did he get where he got. All right, feel free to stand up, come on up here, whatever you want.
Okay, so now I'm doing 4, 5, and 6?
4, 5, and 6. And if you want to reference part of 3 or anything, that'd be great. And is it possible if we have a timekeeper?
Okay, well, I don't think I'll be going 5 minutes, so.
All right. Yeah. I'll set it just for fun. All right, go ahead, take your time then.
So, question 4 is, how does this passage connect to the gospel of Jesus Christ? And so I had 3 points here. One simply is that God fulfills his prophetic utterances. 2, sin is judged. And 3, this may be a little bit of a stretch, but it occurs to me that the capture of the ark appears on the surface to be a major failure. But actually it was foreordained as a great triumph for God. And in a similar way, the cross could appear to be an utter failure, but was actually God's foreordained greatest triumph. The argument to advance to your audience, no matter how out of control life or situations may seem, God is always in control. The second is that God will not be used. And third, that God is always and most concerned with his glory, and we are given the privilege to glorify him. And last, number 6, applications. God is more concerned with our internal relationship with him than our external one. God will judge sin. God will fulfill his plans and purposes and his prophecies. And lastly, in every situation, we can be confident that just as much as God will judge sin and evil, he also works everything for the good of those who love him.
Awesome. Do you want to go into any more detail about how you may be... Well, let's do first
responders. I was going to say, don't steal my question. It sounded like you were about to.
I was about to.
Good for you, Josh.
So I really like your connection to the cross there, the greatest apparent failure being the greatest triumph. My question is directly connected to that. And how would you support, in general, that connection, but more specifically, I'm wondering, where do you see the foreordained capture of the ark in that passage? Like, I mean, obviously, everything's under God's control, but does that passage specifically say that it was God's intent for the ark to be captured at that point?
Actually, no.
Okay.
It doesn't. But I guess I was making an assumption that it wouldn't have happened unless God had foreordained it.
Right.
And I guess in a sense that was one of the first really major wake-up calls to Israel. Because it was probably the most tragic thing that had happened, you know, since they'd entered the Promised Land.
Right.
Might be able to make the argument that the Philistines weren't expecting to be able to capture the ark. Like, they were in fear of the ark.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And so, you know, they had the right, potentially the right attitude, and then, therefore, if they were in fear of who was basically the ark represented, then obviously the person who the ark represented had to allow it to happen, perhaps.
Right, no, that's a good point. And not only were they, I mean, they were not confident at all they were going to win against the Israelites because of the ark was there. I mean, they were genuinely afraid, in spite of the fact that they went ahead with their battle.
Well, also, it says, you know, the Lord of hosts who is enthroned on the cherubim. I mean, he had to allow that to happen. Not necessarily that he planned it ahead like the cross, but it's that aspect.
Yeah, I suppose it's kind of hard to steal a throne out from somebody who's sitting on it.
I think that's supposed to be part of the humor of this passage for those that know in past what has happened since. Obviously, this is really a tragic passage, but when you get to five, there should be something like, they tried what?
Yeah.
What did they think was going to happen?
In retrospect, but not immediately. Great questions. All right, Sandra,
or
right.
Steve,
you want to go next? Which one? Still, Sandra.
Go ahead, I'm still catching my breath.
All
sorry,
right.
Emily. Dad, I know you prepared a worksheet. I know I didn't ask you that.
Yeah, I do have copies. Does that help?
Yes, copies help a lot. Sean, can you pass those out?
Yeah, you can.
After picking them up off the floor. Thanks.
This is the colored one, so there's two. The color is supposed to explain how my brain works. That may be scary.
Mine doesn't have any color.
Did you get this one? The online worksheet?
Thanks.
Oh, color?
Thank you. I have the colored one.
Any more of the other one?
Thank you. Have you guys ever picked up like someone else's Bible and then found like, you know, 1,000 marks in it, like circles and highlights and everything?
I have my grandma's Bible.
Isn't it fascinating? Isn't it exciting
to kind of get the color
like, what did they see? What are we looking at here? Why was that? And then, you know, kind of re-blaze some of the trails already blazed and find things. I think that's one of the exciting things about being a community is being able to share with one another what you're seeing and see things from different angles and different people's perspectives. So I hope you guys find in this just like an opportunity to do this amongst yourselves, and even on a minor level, like here's a picture of my Bible this morning. You know, it's going to be a stress version of it, but yeah, same idea. All right, when you're ready, and can we have a first responder? Charlotte, you want to do a first response? All right, so basically one encouragement, and then, you know, one question to get in deeper of the prove it kind of deal. All right, all time.
So the great reason to do this is you get to take your mask off for 5 minutes. All right, so I gave you this, and what you look at that, what you'll see is arc is in every paragraph in the purple. And so to me, the passage just screamed arc. And so that gave me my structure. So the arc considered, the arc in the camp, the arc captured, the arc reported, the arc mourned. So I've got that one phrase at the beginning, the word of Samuel came to all Israel, which just doesn't fit anywhere. But it's interesting that it seems to be a top and tail. The word of Samuel came to all Israel. The last verse of the passage, the glory has departed from Israel. So there seems to be some play there that I use. And there almost seems to be a chiasm. If you think the ark considered, the ark in the camp, the ark captured, the ark reported captured, the ark mourned. So the key being the ark captured. So the emphasis for me, Israel rises and falls with the ark. I'll skip over context because I think we're trying to make time here.
Whatever you want to do.
Okay, cool. So literary, there was no word in Israel for a long time. The word of the Lord has now come. That's a very significant point. And then afterwards, you see this whole story where God can obviously take care of himself when the ark is in the camp of the Philistines. Historically, you've got this declining glory in Israel for the period of Judges, right up to the establishment of the king. Cultural, so myths abound, you know, in culture, and it seems to be in Israel as well, you know, the trusses in the ark, the icon, and stuff like that. And that's even captured in the passage as far as what the Philistines are afraid of is the icon is in the camp. So, to me, the argument being advanced to his audience is it's not about the ark. So, to me, the gospel connection jumps in here when Jesus says, I tell you something greater than the temple is here. That locking into things that represent God rather than God himself is predominant in human hearts. So it didn't stop, unfortunately, in the book of Samuel. And so to me, that's just driving the relation to us. What is it that we're trusting in rather than God himself? So some possibilities, trusting in crosses and church buildings, infant baptisms, devotions, statues, apparitions, signs and wonders, holy days, holy sites, behavior, performance, mood, emotions, thoughts. These are all icons, all gods we can go to. And it's like, it's not about the ark, you know. It's about God, so. Here you go.
Great, thank you. You want to stay up here, Charlotte?
One of the things that I thought you did really well is that you talked about how important the ark was all the way through. But I think even better is you ultimately said, but it's not about the ark. And I think a lot of times when we read, especially things like the Bible, it's really easy to only focus on that what looks like it's there on the page and forget or not see what actually is happening, because the word, it's not saying God, 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 it's saying ark, ark, ark. And I think that's a really good observation, and it's a big help for a lot of us. I guess the question that I would ask is, so when at the end you're talking about not trusting in things like crosses, church buildings, which I completely agree with, so if that's true, why would God provide things like the ark and put such an emphasis on the ark if it really is about him?
I have 5 minutes to think about that.
You have 2 minutes.
I believe God is merciful to reach us out to us who are human, who have limitations, especially in realms of eternal. And it's an interesting how many of the parables, you know, bread, sheep, wheat, he gets places that we can understand until he takes us to the greater truth. Mm-hmm. And so we see the whole Old Testament was types and shadows. They can figure that out, they can understand that. It was speaking to something much greater. So they weren't supposed to stay with those types and shadows, but types and shadows are God's mercy to communicate to us.
I think that's excellent. It's very well done.
Yeah.
Maybe an interesting analogy that came to me is like, if you're going to go visit a friend's place for Thanksgiving dinner and they give you a map, you're like, oh, I've got a map. I'll put it in the middle of my table and I'll have Thanksgiving dinner here.
Yeah.
And it's not the same as following the map. Because mm-hmm. The map is you're not focusing on the map, you're focusing on what the end of the map points at.
Right.
I have one thought.
Yeah.
Just kind of follow up to what you were saying as you were talking about types and shadows and how God gives those to us to see him, bread and such, like you pointed out. And then we can also use the types and shadows like you listed on the bottom, crosses and infant baptisms and devotions or whatever, to make those our gods as well.
Is there a scripture, and I know it's in the back of my head, that you could point to where God's saying, don't look at earthly things, look at things above? Is that the scripture I'm trying to think? You know,
There's a couple. The one, the first, go ahead. Anyone else? There's probably three or four.
I'm trying to think of ones.
The first one that comes to my mind is when God is talking about the temple and the people swearing by the gold in the temple. He's like, I make the gold in the temple sacred. I make these things sacred. You should be concerned about what I think and my laws, and yet you're kind of revising your laws on this shadow level. The Lord does not dwell in temples made by human hands. Heaven is his throne, earth is his footstool. Scriptures like those come to mind as God is trying to raise their eyes off of this, the symbol, to the meaning behind it. I do not delight in bulls and offerings and sacrifices. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Those kinds of things come to mind.
The whole first half book of Hebrews.
Yes.
You know, the better covenant, the new covenant, the better priest, the new priest.
And
better
he calls sacrifice. These things
yes.
symbols in that, and kind of helps us point them to what they're supposed to be helping us with.
But in that, God clearly gives reminder, like he sets aside feast days, and he has the ark, and he commands them to build the temple and things like that. So it's like a scale, you know. It's both.
I think it gets really exciting when you talk about, you know, God using this to communicate. Children can understand these simple things when you take a goat out in the wilderness and lay your hands on it and say, all the sins of the people are on this goat, and send them out into exile. And, you know, like a child can sort of feel and understand these visual images very clearly. And it's really helpful sometimes.
Yeah. I think Israel had a history of taking those types and shadows and then worshiping them, like the bronze snake on the pole. All those symbols and things. It doesn't mean that the types and shadows are bad. It just means that we're lunkheads.
All right, Sandra, you ready?
Good morning. Okay. So, what is the argument being advanced by the author to his audience? I said, Israel is defeated, Eli and his sons are dead, and the ark is captured. That the author is saying to his audience.
Can you say it one more time? I'll do it one more time.
Sorry. Israel is defeated, Eli and his sons are dead, and the ark is captured.
Right, keep going. Thanks.
All right. So then, how does the passage connect to the gospel of Jesus Christ? I said, our need for a Savior and God preparing the way. The Israelites are defeated by the Philistines, but instead of turning to God by asking Eli, they could do, but he is old and ineffectual, or they could ask Samuel, who is young, but instead of doing that, they bring the ark to their camp. They're routed, the ark is captured, Eli and his sons are killed, the glory has departed from Israel, they need a godly priest or a godly king. What argument will you advance to your audience? No matter how bad things look, God is on his throne. How bad things look, God is on his throne. All right, what applications will you make? Number one, there's treating the Ark of the Covenant like a good luck charm, or like an icon, or trying to manipulate God in some way. We can treat our quiet times, our church and our care group attendance like that, even our prayers like that. You know, I did this thing, and so God, you're supposed to be doing your thing. That's number one. Number two, I said, sometimes our leadership fails us, but God is still on his throne. So in our church, we had two church splits, basically about methods, but God is still on his throne. He is working out his salvation for his people. And then the third application is, for me, when everything looks as bleak as can be, when you've made all kinds of mistakes and failed, God is still on his throne. He is arranging for his kingdom to advance. He has provided the high priest that we need, just as he provided Samuel for that time.
Thanks.
Thanks.
All right, I didn't ask for a first responder, but can we have one?
I can do it. I actually like the point about leadership, because one of the things I guess I skimmed over when reading it is it's the elders who are the ones who are going over and saying, hey, we need to go get this ark lying in front of us. And I think it's important for us today, especially, you know, looking at whatever kind of leadership is above us, it's, you know, God is still in control. And, you know, God directs the heart of the king wherever he wishes.
And also I was thinking that for the people alive at that time, Phineas and the other guy, they are the leaders. You know, they are the priests doing these terrible things, but they are the officially recognized leaders. You know, and the people of that time don't know that they don't know the Lord. You can kind of figure that out, sort of. But, you know, at that time, they wouldn't have known. Just like for us now, you know, we have our leaders. You know, we don't know how they're doing with the Lord or things like that, but it doesn't matter. You know, and at our particular church, all of our leaders knew the Lord, where you don't have any disagreements about theology and stuff like that. It's more like practices. But that, you know, no matter what, God is on his throne. He is working out his salvation for his people.
Jeff, do you have a question for...
Yeah, it's just your application sounded more like a summary of the events that happened. I'm not sure...
Can you reread your application?
Sorry, the argument. Not
the argument, yes.
Oh, the argument? Yes. I said no matter how bad things look, God is on his throne.
Oh, maybe I just misheard that. I thought you'd listen up stuff that had happened.
I think what you started with was the author's argument.
Yeah.
Can you go back up to that?
That's probably what I was confused.
You said Israel's defeated, Eli and his sons are dead, and the ark is captured.
That's the, yes.
So, yeah, so then
gotcha,
how is that an argument, I guess?
Gotcha. I didn't think about that.
Well, let's take a shot. You know, and there's plenty more time to think about this. But so, you know, you wrote down that there was a defeat, a major defeat. You know, sons were killed. Eli's dead. The generation's at its end. There's Ichabod moment at the end. So you have a structure. I think the emphasis you kind of called out on the fly last time was that Israel's in great trouble, or I threw down Israel's in great distress. If that is kind of what is the feel of this, what might the author of Samuel be trying to get across to the people of Israel? What is he trying to tell them? Because it's not just facts. There's a meaning, there's a purpose behind telling these facts in this way. You want to give it a shot?
No, I really liked what Steve said about there's more than the ark, you know, going on here.
It's not easy, right? Because you have a bunch of facts, and it's not the whole story, right? This is one piece in a story that's flowing very fast.
I do feel like this is what the author is saying in this chapter, so what's the difference between a summary and an argument?
What's the reason for him telling the story?
A little bit that I got is maybe God is kind of trying to show Israel you can't just rest on your laurels. You know, just because you're God's chosen people, it's not an automatic thing. You know, you still have to treat me as the God of the universe, as the holy God. And you can't let those sun, can't let that slip, can't forget that. So, because there's going to be consequences.
I guess maybe I would say that the argument would be that they need a godly priest or a godly king. Because Samuel's sort of setting up for David. So,
can I ask a question? Kind of a question? Sort of like a final question.
Yeah.
I read this, and going back to what somebody said earlier about like providence and whether this happened on purpose or not. And my question is, how many holy
promises are being fulfilled in this chapter.
Holy?
Yeah, like God send, God word, fulfillments of like, I will do X, Y, and Z. And then this passage is written out, like, that's what happens.
Well, there's the death of Eli and his sons.
Yeah.
That was definitely a promise. That's been fulfilled.
Yeah.
You want to listen more?
No, I wanted to present another possibility.
Yeah.
Is an emphasis, could it be that it's all about God's presence for this people?
Because it said the glory had departed.
I'm going to try to do my best, God help me, to pull these together.
Because wasn't the ark a symbol of God's presence?
I think part of what he's showing with this is God is present with his people. They're not seeing it. That's one thing that's going on. And through his proclamation to Eli that his generation is going to end, that the priesthood is being transferred to someone else, and the sign of it is going to be Eli and Hophni and Phinehas dying in the same day. And happenstance, Eli dies a day later as a start of a fulfillment of this, who's judged Israel for 40 years, which means that that whole judge period is now being transferred over. And as a result, you have the sort of decaying line of Eli's sons kind of showing up, where the next named born son is named Ichabod. The glory has departed. I can't imagine a worse name for a priest to have. Your name means God's left. You're supposed to be God's connection to his people, and your name means he's left. So there's a whole bunch of promises being fulfilled in this passage, and God is showing it. I think the most surprising thing that happens in this passage is the ark gets captured, because that wasn't on the list of promises. But, go ahead.
I just have this picture of Hophni and Phinehas front and back carrying the ark with slimy, sinful, horrible hands, touching it because they were allowed to, kind of, into battle, being like, well, since we've got this, we're going to win. Like, the holiness of God will protect us.
I think the ark being captured is two or three things. Well, it's a surprise for one, but it's a symbol that God is doing something. He is leaving his people. That's what he says in Jeremiah, so I feel comfortable saying that he abandons his people at Shiloh. Mm. And so what is the meaning of this? God's fulfilling his promises. God's abandoning his people for a purpose. And I think we have to try to figure out what that purpose is. I agree. The argument is hard to...
I guess I'm going to say that the argument is that we need, we need a godly priest, or we need a godly king. That's what I think that the author is trying to say.
I think there are supporting instances, for example, God being on his throne and the judges transfer that support that.
But also this was a time of a shift in history.
Yes.
With the territories and stuff, because it says that Eli's death was showing, and Ichabod was showing up to a new leadership at that time.
Yes. Thank you, Sandra. Appreciate it. I'm gonna have a time up again. 12 minutes. I'm gonna try to throw out one more gospel connection. I think what's most exciting to me on this, there's a lot of things that are really great here, is the ark does appear on one instance to be a failure. it's kind of the one thing that wasn't prophesied to happen. And when I think of, like, when else did this kind of event happen, I think of God, Jesus, coming to the temple and basically reordering the priesthood. And he rejects the leaders at that time, the priests at that time, the whole system, and even to some extent the Jews temporarily, to graft in the Gentiles and create a new priesthood. And when Jesus goes to the cross, is an interesting parallel that he appears to be abandoning his people. And he appears to be a failure moment where I'm sure someone thought at that day when Jesus died, we're lost.
And also he's in the power of the Romans, like the ark was in the belonging of the Philistines.
Yeah. Jesus gets captured, and it's an interesting moment, right? And he gets captured for a reason. I think that the reason is very similar, because why is God doing this to his people? I think part of it is to purify his people. Purify in cutting off the evil line of priests and to prepare a holy priesthood for himself, first through Samuel and the priesthood that comes, and eventually us through Jesus as our high priest. And all of that's a surprise. It wasn't expected. And so I think, Rob, one of your points was that, you know, what appeals to be a great failure is actually one of the greatest triumphs. And yeah, that's here too. What appears to be a great failure is God triumphing.
Because the Israelites were living under the earth of the covenant, the laws and regulations of that covenant, and they were depending. And I think it's also a time of testing.
Yes. So, yeah, I get excited about that one. When it comes to the argument, I think a lot of what we have here is really great in terms of leadership and who are you trusting in and what are you trusting in. But I think there's a strong caution, I think comes from, I'll pull up the Hebrews. The reason God seems to have done this in chapter 2 is because Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were treating the offering of the Lord with contempt. So when I think, for us, what is the connection and how do we apply it for us? What is our offering and sacrifice? When you look up offering and sacrifice in the New Testament, there's surprisingly little. There's talk about offering your bodies as living sacrifices. But in general, Hebrews seems to call out that our offering is Jesus. He was offered for us once for all. And his exhortation to us when talking about this offering. Is to let hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. And he says, if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy. How much more worse punishment do you think will be deserved by the one who has trampled underfoot the Son of God and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has outraged the spirit of grace? And that keeps going. But the thought that for us, we are priests holding in our hands the sacrifice of God that he's won for us. And how we handle that and how we treat that is a matter of great importance, specifically in terms of us going on sinning deliberately. It's not a simple matter. And he destroyed his people and Shiloh because of that. And Hebrews' response to that is, they were just holding this. The law of Moses was this. And they died in the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse is it going to be for those who trample underfoot the Son of God and outrage the Holy Spirit? And that scares me. And I think Hebrews comes with a ton of words of comfort as well. It's in the same passage that he's talking about approaching the throne of grace. The seat on which the ark is called the mercy seat. It's both the seat of judgment and of mercy. But I think there's a strong application here to look at what happened to God's people at Shiloh and say, this was set down as a warning for us. And many other things, right? It's also showing us who God is, that he's a God that fulfills all of his promises, a God that can fight for himself, a God who's, like you said, not going to be used, right? And so I think you can bring in all of Steve's application about what are we trusting, are we trusting God or the objects? But yeah, I think there's a lot. I'm excited about this. This is all of you guys, and putting it all on the board, seeing it. I hope you guys have come to enjoy this experience and get more out of it. But, so yeah, this is our last class. Any other last thoughts on this?
Yeah, when I think about the ark, wasn't mentioned that it was going to be captured.
Yeah.
There's a scripture where God says he won't give his glory to another.
Mm-hmm.
And every time we falsely put our glory in the wrong things,
right,
God in his mercy doesn't let it stay there.
Right.
Because he doesn't want our focus to be on the false.
Yeah.
That's really good, because the evidence that they were doing that is that they decided to just drag the ark over to where, you know, to be in their camp.
I think a personal application for me is to talk to God and not assume that his objects bring me God's blessing. Like Dad said, devotions is one of those things you just throw in your list and say, like, are you trusting in the fact that you, like, read the Bible this morning? And what the Israelites should have done after that first defeat, which I expected them to do when they asked the question, why has God defeated us, is say, is talk to him. And go to God and say, well, Lord, why have you defeated us? Well, you know, what do you want us to learn? What do you want us to do? And so, yes, God is on his throne, but it's great to be with him wherever he's going. So if things in your life aren't going well, talk to God. Maybe it's because you're doing the righteous thing and being on the righteous path, like Job. Or maybe it's not. Either way, God's who you should talk to. You have a thought?
Just in the viewing, or Ari said, this is like a great defeat, and afterwards there's sort of empty, like we've been utterly defeated and the glory is left, and how that mimics the cross. When he wrote this, I believe, and we know, like the second part of the story.
Right.
And like the ark does a whole bunch of work by itself. Like it doesn't need to be rescued. They don't need to mount a rescue plan to go get God back or free him from the captured Philistine prison. And I almost see this defeat as a fulfillment of all of these bad promises. But he goes off and he does a whole bunch of really positive work for the people of Israel,
yeah,
in the Philistine camp, all by himself.
Yes.
To usher in a new age where the Philistines are like, we'll hand you back your super weapon with golden treasures,
yeah,
and not touch you, and then enter a new reign and era for Israel.
What this does bring about is the revival in Israel that Samuel says, how long are you going to go keep waffling between these two gods?
Yeah.
And it was an awesome salvation that God brought by himself.
I'm almost curious, from a numbers perspective, it's 30,000 compared to what actually went down over the course of the next year. Was that a small number?
I would say it's at least equivalent, if not, yeah.
Well, what I think is really cool, and probably other people are with me, because, you know, before taking this class, I'm going to read this chapter, I'm going to be like, well, there's not much I can get out of that one, better read the next chapter. And then when we think about all that we have been able to see in this chapter, so
Thank you, you done.
Well, that is my goal, is because there's so much of the Old Testament that seems like, I don't really know what to do with this, and I want people to see glory in it and the purposes of God in it. So I'm excited that you're seeing. Thank you all for being here.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks, Jack.